This time on your weekly Constitutional.
So Madison sits down to figure out what's wrong with American federalism. And he does it in a way that combines both history and, in a sense, political science. He reflects both on past experience, but also on what were the structural conditions of the entire situation, the working premises of American federalism, which would best explain why the system wasn't going to work.
That was Stanford historian Jack Rakove, who has written a book on James Madison called A Politician Thinking: The Creative Mind of James Madison. Jack also serves on the board of the Montpelier Foundation. And recently, when I was out there, we sat down and had a chat. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional. And this week, it's about a politician thinking.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Jack Rakove is among the most prominent scholars of James Madison in the world. He has written a number of books about Madison and his times, and recently he's published a new one. It's called A Politician Thinking: The Creative Mind of James Madison. I've had the pleasure of reading this book, and it's a great one. And it takes a perspective that others have perhaps overlooked. That's that Madison was not just a historian, not just a fellow who sat in his library and read books by Montesquieu and others, but someone who thought in very pragmatic terms. In fact, so carefully and pragmatically did he think that he was an early practitioner of something that currently we call game theory. Recently, Jack and I sat down at the Potter Studios at Montpelier, and we had ourselves a fascinating chat.
I'm Jack Rakove. I'm a professor of history and political science at Stanford University, where I've taught, as I like to say, ever since the Reagan years. I went there in 1980 after teaching for 5 years at Colgate University in upstate New York. My original field of training was to teach early American history, meaning the 17th and the 18th century. But over the course of my career, I've become more and more of a constitutional historian. Most of my scholarship has revolved around the origins of the American Revolution and the Constitution. I'm basically kind of a 1770s and 1780s guy in terms of how historians think themselves, though I think I'm also fairly competent for the 1760s and the 1790s. And my teaching is much broader. When I teach the first part of the Early American History Survey, which I think I'm going to do one last time at Stanford before I retire, but I go back to the late 16th, early 17th century. I teach a course on the constitutional history of the United States, which comes down to the present. And, over the course of my career, I've taught American foreign policy, and I've taught the 19th century, and I teach some kind of Euro-American courses as well. I do one on religious toleration.
So, Jack, is there anything you don't teach?
Yeah, there are lots of things I don't teach. But, I'm not strong on gender issues. I mean, I work them into some of my course readings. I do focus. I was trained as a political historian, and I'm one of those who still thinks that politics is first in importance in terms of the relevance of history to other disciplines. But when you have the chance to teach and you have the chance to teach smart students, which has been my great fortune at Stanford, you're open to doing pretty much anything.
Sure.
So I use a lot of my courses to kind of catch up on other fields. So, I teach social history and a little cultural history and intellectual history. But first and foremost, I am kind of a politics guy.
One of these days, I'm going to have you in this booth and we're going to talk about the 17th century, because I've always considered that to be sort of the dark century in American history, at least as far as the public perception. It's always been my thought that people start with Plymouth Rock. And then they skip forward to the Declaration of Independence as if nothing happened in that 150 or so year period. And there were a lot did happen, as you know. But that's not our subject today. Actually, our subject today is going to be the Constitution. But before we get there, I'm going to have to call you out on your modesty, because you actually won a Pulitzer Prize. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a great experience. In fact, so I like to say it's so nice an experience, you wish it could happen to everyone. But since that can't be the case, it's better it happens to you
than finally an honest man
than someone else. Well, actually, the three finalists my year, interestingly, were all we all worked with the same editor, the legendary Jane Garrett, who's a very famous editor at Knopf. So, yeah, I suppose it was, in a sense, an ambition of mine, but one knows when you're fortunate enough to win a prize, you can't bet on that kind of thing happening. So
that was 96, wasn't it?
The book came out in 96. Right. I won in 97.
And it was on originalism, right?
It's my book called Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution.
Okay.
So, in fact, it's a historian's approach to how to think about the original meaning of the Constitution, which remains a hot subject now, 20 years later. So it's actually a funny story. So I came back from, I'd spent that winter with my wife and our younger son. I'd taught at Stanford's program in Oxford, mm-hmm. England.
Oh, tough duty.
It's a tough work, but someone has to do it. And we came back, I think, about a week earlier. And my editor, Jane, had dropped me a note saying, well, it's announced at 3 p.m. Eastern time, noon on the West Coast. And if anything happens, I'll give you a call. So I was still in my office. I was kind of catching up on my email. Just been back a couple of days. And there was email in 1997, though the systems were a lot more primitive. Mm-hmm. And Jane called. And she said, well, Jack, you got it. And,
wow.
So we talked for about a minute or two. And then, we hung up. And that was great news. And, I called my wife. My wife had forgotten it was going to happen. I said, Helen, the Pulitzer's announced today, so we'll see what happens. But my mom, who was still alive at that point and, was actually still working, so I called my mom. And I think my mom remembered that something might happen. And then I called my son and my older son, who was a sophomore at Stanford, and I left a message on his phone. And that actually became, when the Stanford PR people did a story about it, that was the lead, because Rob wasn't there. So I said, like, Rob, hi, is your dad? You might want to give me a call later. I just won the Pulitzer. And I hung up and
Absolutely. Well, I think the sweetest part of that story is your mom. Moms never forget, do they?
Well, she was good that way, yeah.
Yeah. Moms are always on your side. Today, our subject is actually some of your more recent work. And I'm going to begin with a question that I've been pondering for months and months now. Another book on James Madison? Why the hell did you write another book on James Madison? Aren't there enough of them out there already?
You mean another book for me or another book in general?
Both. I mean, you've written about him. Others have written about
Well,
him.
I can't stop other people from writing. They all have their First Amendment rights, in part thanks to Madison. So they're free to write what they want. The story is, I had actually thought I had written enough about Madison. I mean, Madison is an important figure in my first book, which is about the Continental Congress. And then I did a short biography of Madison for the Library of American Biography series, which then was actually edited by my former professor, Oscar Handlin. And then Madison does play a pretty prominent role in Original Meanings, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book. And I'd written a number of articles and essays and this, that, and the other thing about him. So in a sense, I thought I had said pretty much everything I had to say. But then I had an invitation to give a set of lectures, the Julian Rothbaum Lectures at the University of Oklahoma. And it was a nice gig, three lectures, treated very well, generous honorarium and so on. And I was the first historian in that series to give a chance to lecture. And it seemed to me this would be a great occasion for me to pull together some thoughts and ideas and concerns that I had developed in different places, but maybe to bring them together in one book. And so I gave three lectures there in 2009, and unfortunately, it took, as often happens, it took me longer to finish the book than I had intended, and they started getting a little restless. So I finished it off. I wrote one more chapter roughly beyond the lectures I'd given. So sometimes those books take the form. You write a short essay, people read it. That's the lecture. You refine it, and publish it. But I can't bear to read a paper. So when I talk, I just hate reading a paper.
I hate listening to people read a paper.
It's a terrible experience. Yeah. So usually I work from an outline.
Mm-hmm.
One or two pages, sometimes three, depending on the forum, but it's fairly short, and then you just try to finish the damn thing. But this guy said, I had to write the thoughts out.
It's called A Politician Thinking, The Creative Mind of James Madison. And the first thing that struck me about it when I received my review copy, I'm looking at the final copy now, but when I received my review copy, was that you have a wonderful picture looking out of the place that I sometimes refer to as the womb of the Constitution, where it was all conceived, the second floor library at Montpelier. And it's that beautiful view looking toward the west, toward the Blue Ridge. it's where he did a lot of his stuff during the winter of 1786 to 1787. But your book goes well beyond that. So what exactly do you discuss in this book?
Well, first off, I think it's worth explaining the title.
Please.
You know, so to call it A Politician Thinking, I really wanted to kind of ask a kind of basic question that I'm not sure historians or other scholars examine enough. What is the nature of political thinking as an activity? We write a lot about the history of political thought, and this distinction may seem a little hokey or problematic to your listeners, but when we write the history of political thought, we write primarily about great texts. You know, we could write about Hobbes' Leviathan or Locke's Second Treatise of Government or Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws and any of or Machiavelli's The Prince or Machiavelli's Discourses on the First Ten Books of Titus Livy and so on. So there's a very well-developed way of how you think about writing the history of great texts and also the lesser texts that sometimes are forgotten but which define the conversation in which the great text appeared. But thinking is an activity. You know, the process of political thinking is something you have to do for your own critical, analytical, programmatic purposes. And I happen to think Madison was first and foremost a thinker more than a writer of great texts. And so I got an interesting question. To put it quite simply, how did Madison's mind work? And how does Madison's mind work, not when he had to justify something, but when he's trying to figure out what to do? And I think the point of departure for this is that at some point, partly because I hang out a lot with political scientists. I'm proud to be a member of two departments at Stanford, both history and political science. And political scientists, although the concerns of historians and political scientists sometimes overlap, they think in very different ways.
Could you describe that? What's the difference?
Well, for one thing, historians are always trying to explain the particular. Why did a particular event happen at a moment in time? Political scientists see themselves developing a body of theory.
Mm-hmm.
Political scientists want to have data sets, you know, collections of evidence that you can subject to certain kinds of tests or certain kinds of analytical procedures that will allow you to draw generalizations, which in turn should provide you with a basis for predicting future behavior. I mean, that's the goal of political science.
The first time I discovered that distinction was as a freshman, I believe, at Princeton, and I was sitting in a class on European history, and the professor, I forget her name, got up there and started talking about nation states and the rise of the nation states. And I must admit that I was a little bit befuddled, as apparently was the rest of the class, because at about the third lecture, a much more brave upperclassman raised his hand, and this was unusual in a lecture class, and he said, Professor, are we ever going to actually get to the history? And she was not happy with the question. I believe she made some disdainful reference to a chronology in the recommended reading list.
Yeah.
But she was a political scientist.
Yeah.
And that's what
yeah.
she wanted to do. She was coming up with theories, and she
right.
just assumed
right.
we knew
right.
the basic facts.
Right.
So I understand that distinction.
Yeah. Well, if you're a historian, then your concern is not with the data set, it's just with the sources.
Yes.
Like what information is available
right.
of any kind that might be relevant. So I think a lot about the difference, but in part because I worked with political scientists, particularly a couple of my colleagues at Stanford, but others elsewhere, I started to realize that there was a game theoretic aspect of Madison's thinking.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Jack Rakove, a historian and political scientist from Stanford University, who also sits on Montpelier's board. After the break, we'll continue our discussion with Jack. Stick around. And now it's time to continue our discussion with Jack Rakove, who sits on Montpelier's board and who also is a historian and political scientist from Stanford University. Jack and I sat down recently at the Potter Studios at Montpelier to discuss his new book, A Politician Thinking, The Creative Mind of James Madison. And one really interesting aspect that we've just started talking about is how perhaps Madison was an early practitioner of something we now call game theory.
There's a lot of game theory in political science and also in economics. And game theory is a way of trying to look at any kind of human interaction and involves any of a number of realms of activity, and ask what are the strategic aspects of what people are trying to do. And so it there's a whole vocabulary there. I mean, the way I explain this to my students, it doesn't work anymore because the program's not there. But I used to say, to illustrate this in a fairly direct way, to talk about NYPD Blue, you know, the old TV show.
Yeah.
With, you know,
a great show.
Yeah, Dennis France and Jimmy Smits, and, you know, actually a pretty good cast. And because that was always about the prisoner's dilemma, which is a famous example in game theory. You know, you arrest, and I mean, if I explain it now, I'll probably make a mess of it. But basically, the argument is, you know, any given show, you know, a crime takes place, and then there's a backstory, of course, involving the, you know, the police crew. But they identify a few witnesses, and they start getting some testimony, and usually they discover there are two or three people or more involved, and they arrest them and they put them in different rooms. And that's when the prisoner's dilemma works, because the optimal strategy for anybody arrested is to shut up and not say anything, or at least the best collective strategy. But the optimal individual strategy is you flip first.
Right.
Because if you wait, you have to say, you know, they say, I can make you a deal if you tell us what really happened. But if the other guy talks, you're going to be screwed.
Right.
And so that's actually the recurring motif. So that's just one example. There are multiple forms of game theory. But I came to understand, and it's really the subject of chapter one in the book of Politician Thinking, is Madison's approach, the whole problem of American federalism, as it operated under the Articles of Confederation, you know, the period, well, especially after 1781, but really the whole period of the Revolutionary War and then the 1780s, essentially represented a game theoretic approach.
Really?
To the problem of federalism. That's something I try to explain in a great length. And he glimpses this at a fairly early point. He glimpses this when he was a member of the Continental Congress in the early 1780s.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to think about the basic problem is will the individual state governments cooperate with or in effect fulfill their obligations to the Continental Congress and the Federal Union under the Articles of Confederation? Or to use the language of game theory, will they shirk their duties? So will they cooperate or will they shirk? And cooperation and shirking are two poles.
And the best collective strategy is for everyone to cooperate.
Yeah,
but
and
the
also
best individual strategy may be very different.
Right, right. And so the operative assumption, Madison, you know, spells this out brilliantly in this very famous document, the document called The Vices of the Political System of the United States, which he drafts probably 6 weeks or so before the Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia in May 1787. Madison was concerned with the basic problem of federalism under the Articles of Confederation was that, as it had been formed, was that the states were simply expected to do what Congress asked them to do. And the logic of the system, the theory of the system was that Congress, you know, there was no national bureaucracy. Congress is a kind of collective body, usually a couple dozen delegates coming and going from the different states. So Congress would frame a general set of policies, but they expected the states would have the knowledge and the capacity at the provincial and local level to know the best way to implement what Congress was asking them to do. So Congress didn't really have the information needed to legislate broadly in the way that the modern Congress, God forbid, you know, is supposed to be able to act. So the idea was you devolve this authority to the states. But the expectation was, because when the Articles were framed in the mid-1770s, Americans were deeply patriotic. They simply assumed as a matter of course that the states would do what they were asked to do. But then over the course of the Revolution, and on into the early 1780s, that strategy became more and more problematic. And so Madison sits down to figure out what's wrong with American federalism. And he does it in a way that combines both history and, in a sense, political science. It, you know, he reflects both on past experience, but also on what were the structural conditions of the entire situation, the working premises of American federalism, which would best explain why the system wasn't going to work. So that was, in a sense, that was, you know, I don't mean to prattle on about this, Stuart, but that was kind of
perfectly all right. You know,
that was my point of departure to realize, okay, when Madison thinks about federalism, here's how his mind is working. He has this very well-balanced approach.
And he was thinking as a political scientist. He wasn't simply saying what happened. He was saying, why is it happening?
Well, he was thinking as both. I mean, that's the interesting part. And to me, it seems to be, you know, I mean, kind of like my own career, so maybe that's the sense in which I'm a Madisonian, that the historical and the, let's say, the social scientific lobes of his brain, or the, you know, the globes or whatever, that they were actually quite well proportioned in a way that's actually, I think, in some ways kind of distinctive. So he could reason empirically about what had gone wrong in the past, but then he could take a step back from that and try to generalize about what were the structural properties, what were the underlying conditions that would persist.
What were his basic conclusions? What was wrong with American federalism under the Articles of Confederation?
Well, I think the first two basic conclusions, as you know, once he defines a problem, is that A, we had been naive, you know, but for good reasons. I mean, not for bad reasons, but we'd been naive back in the mid-1770s, and then we'd learned a lot of lessons since. Okay, so that's the first two parts of the.
So maybe there wasn't quite as much civic virtue out there as people.
Well, we discovered if there was, it couldn't last indefinitely, and that other conditions would assert themselves. Okay, but then so he makes this is item 7 in the memorandum on the vice of the political system. You know, your readers can look it up. It's readily available online. You can go to the Founders Constitution website, the University of Chicago. Just you know, type in James Madison, Vices of the Political System, and you'll get very easy access.
Okay.
And actually, it's available in other places as well, so it's easy to read it. So look at item 7. So the first two items are inherently historical. And then he asks the question, how indeed could it be otherwise? And as I say in the book, when Madison asks a question, it's not rhetorical. It's analytical. He's asking a question because there's a genuine question there that he was trying to answer. And in effect, what he says is, then he comes up with essentially three propositions. One, he says that, look, let's think about the states. They have different interests. We can't expect them to apply equally on every given concern. You know, I may be thinking about Virginia's condition in 1781 when it's being invaded by Cornwallis. What do they care about that in New Hampshire or whatever? Or, you know, or flip it around. But he says, okay, you know, we can't expect the states to have an equal stake, and this is game theoretic language, to have an equal stake in every outcome on every issue. Secondly, he says, within every state, you'll have the problem. He uses the phrase courtiers of popularity. We'll always have people running who want to run against, or we'll always have people competing who will be, you know, for their own ambitions, critical of what the national government's trying to do. You know, today, I think we'd use the phrase running against Washington, meaning not the president, but the capital city, a recurring motif in American politics, particularly, of course, within, you know, the latter day, the modern day Republican Party. But the whole idea of running against Washington, running against the national government. So you'll always have, the problem. You'll have, if you ask the states to carry out the business, some group of actors within the states may have their own immediate incentives for saying, to quote Borat, nish-nish. This is not something we want to do. And then third, the most interesting point, says, even when there's a common disposition to do the right thing, our doubts about whether or not the other states will comply will discourage us from acting first. That's to say, there'll be a lot of net drag in the system because we'll be skeptical about whether or not other states are going to do it. And if they're not going to cough up, why should we go first? And then Madison reached the conclusion, these considerations will never fail to render federal measures abortive. In other words, the system will always be vulnerable to breakdown.
So that's a lot. So in the 1780s, Madison was in the process of becoming a cynic, is what you're saying.
Well, no, I don't think it's cynicism. But I mean,
skepticism?
Well, no, he's skeptical about a given point. I mean, he's saying what he's skeptical about is the working assumption of the Articles of Confederation. Working assumption was that the states would faithfully comply using their own legislative discretion to do it in the most efficient way possible. Madison's saying, as a system of federalism, what we now, you know, if you want to make this system of federalism work, we now have enough data and really enough he thinks, you know, now a theoretical rationale to say why,
This reminds me of a lot of stuff that was coming out of Hamilton and out of George Washington at this time, and they'd learned these lessons rather bitterly during the Revolutionary War, hadn't they?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, actually, that's an excellent point. I think, you know, Madison, looking at it more from a political side, is reaching the same conclusion that, you know, that whole group of Continental Army officers around Washington and Hamilton, Henry Knox would have agreed, you know, this became Secretary of War. I think they would have accepted. In fact, if you read Federalist 15, which was written by Hamilton, Hamilton essentially repeats Madison's analysis. In fact, I think Hamilton, I wonder whether Hamilton had Madison's, literally whether Hamilton had Madison's, a working draft of Madison's vices with him. Or he certainly understood the argument and recapitulates it pretty, you know, pretty closely to what Madison was saying. So, yeah, I think that did become a unifying theme of the Federal Convention.
And this is, of course, the period when Madison was in his most nationalist phase, when he and Hamilton right. were best buds.
Right. In fact, I think this may be the best explanation
yeah.
of why Hamilton was in his, excuse me, why Madison was in his most nationalist phase.
Very interesting.
It wasn't a problem for Hamilton.
Right.
It may have been a bit more of a problem, although I don't think so, for Madison.
So Madison is diagnosing all these ills of federalism under the Articles.
Yeah, vices.
Vices, exactly. And so what is his prescription? What does Dr. Madison recommend to fix the patient?
Yeah. Actually, Madison did receive an honorary doctorate just after the convention was over from the College of New Jersey,
right?
Now Princeton, which I guess you attended, but also my younger son is a Princeton grad.
Congratulations to him.
As it happens. Mm-hmm. He wasn't that happy there. But anyhow, although his... You know,
Madison liked it.
Madison liked it a lot.
Madison liked it a lot.
Yeah, in fact, Princeton claims Madison as its first graduate student.
Indeed it does.
As you may remember.
I've always felt, as an alum, even as a student, that we put a lot more emphasis on Woodrow Wilson.
Right.
Than we did on Madison, and right. then maybe we had that backward.
Right, right.
But be that as it may, please continue.
Yeah, wait, let's go back to the original question, which I just...
Yes.
Which I just lost.
Oh, the original question was, what is the diagnosis? I mean, excuse me, what is the prescription?
Right. Yeah, oh, right, yeah. So, yeah, the basic diagnosis is it's a fairly straightforward one with very powerful implications. So the basic diagnosis is if you're not going to have a national government act through the states... You know, the states, you know, under the Articles of Confederation, the states, in effect, were the administrative auxiliaries,
right.
agents of the national government. So what's the alternative to that? The alternative is you need to have a national government that's going to act directly on the population by virtue of law. In fact, the premise for this famous Item 7 in the article in Madison's memorandum on the vices is want of sanction to the laws and coercion in the government of the Confederacy or something like that. So it means that, so the basic point he wants to say is to make it work, the national government needs some coercive mechanisms. Now, you could try to coerce the states. Madison, at different points, even in the early 1780s, has been saying, well, look, to make the Articles of Confederation work, maybe at some points we ought to apply military force against the states. I think what Madison's imagining is they all have ports, you know.
Right.
Even New Hampshire, you know, has a port.
Ouch.
You know, so you, and, you know, Vermont wasn't a state then, so it was an independent republic. So you park a frigate, you know, outside the main harbor.
But that's a less than ideal solution.
Yeah, well, yeah. He says, you know, that's a formula for coercion, not for cooperation. So the idea is you want to have a national government that's capable of enacting, executing, and adjudicating its own laws without having to go through the state governments at all. So in effect, you want to cut the states out of the loop, at least out of the loop of making the national government work. So
I believe the term he used was energetic, right? It had to be an energetic.
Well, energetic is a common term, right? Yeah, a lot of the Federalists use that to say that's the kind of government we want. Yeah, so if it's be energetic, it can't work through the states. It has to work on the population.
And it therefore has to have the ability to directly tax people.
Yeah, and legislate for
and
them.
And legislate for them, and ultimately to have a standing army and navy if that's what's required. Okay, well.
But wait, but there's one more point here, which is once you reach that point, then what you have to do is you have to create a national government in the full sense of the term.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have a unicameral Congress like the Continental Congress, be
right.
the sole or primary, even the sole institution of national government, you need a fully articulated government. You need the usual three departments and probably a bicameral legislature.
And you've already mentioned under the Articles, the Congress basically had no executive. I mean,
right.
it was somebody called the president of the
right.
Congress.
Right.
He didn't have any power.
Well, he's more like a Speaker of the House.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was no independent judiciary.
You could constitute courts, but they were, of a very limited nature.
So there just wasn't much there except the
right.
Congress.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it has to be a whole government.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, one of the best ways of explaining why did the convention take the course it did is that at that point, Americans, and I think Madison certainly illustrates this point quite well, they can start looking at the experience of the governments the Americans had created at the state level, all the constitutions they'd written back in 1776, 1777. And then Massachusetts, 1780. So they had a big body of experience they could draw on. And then they could start drawing lessons on the basis of that experience. And you see this is applied in terms of how they think about issues of representation, the presidency, the idea of an independent judiciary.
And Madison had been very active in Virginia state government. I think that's often overlooked
by
people.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that experience and his advising Patrick Henry and all of that stuff?
Well, he starts out, so Madison's political career started in the spring of 1776, I mean, he attended the 5th Provincial Convention. The conventions were kind of surrogate legislatures that met before independence. And that was the convention that drafted the first state constitution. Then he returns to the first state legislature that met in the fall of 1776. Then he was defeated for re-election in 1777. But the next year, he was elected by the legislature to join the Council of State, which is kind of an executive council for Governor Patrick Henry and then for Jefferson. And then in 1780, 1783, he was in the Continental Congress. He never went home once. Since we're sitting here in outside Orange, Virginia, he never came back to Montpelier once during that period. I can think of one Massachusetts congressman who served in the same way, a guy named James Lovell. Madison wasn't a rare guy. He went to Congress and kind of stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
But then, he was term limited out in the fall of 1783. And then he came back here. He served 3 years in the Virginia Assembly. And most of his students think that his experience, particularly in the mid-1780s in the Virginia Assembly, had a profound impact on his political thinking. That's one of the themes in really kind of chapter two of my book.
Yes, he was very, very active. He was a practical politician. We've often heard that. Of course, his memorial and remonstrance occurred during
then,
this period
when
he decided he was going to oppose Patrick Henry and his
right.
attempt to reimpose taxes
right.
for the benefit of the church.
Right.
So when he finally gets around to designing our Constitution, he's actually had all of this experience to draw upon, and he was applying that as well. In fact, you call him a constitutional engineer. Could you explain that term a little bit?
Yeah, it's a phrase I derived from an Italian friend of mine,
uh-huh.
Pasquale Pasquino, who uh-huh. teaches at Sciences Po in Paris and also hangs out at NYU Law School
mm-hmm.
In the fall. And actually, I hope to see him in Italy. We're going to Italy in a month from now, and I hope to see him. In fact, I know I'm going to see him while I'm there. So Pasquale used that phrase, and I think it's quite apt because I think I say in the book, a constitution, to be a successful engineer, you have to be well-versed in theory, right? You have to understand, mm-hmm. Newton's laws or whatever, all that stuff I knew something about when I was in high school. So there is a big body of theoretical knowledge you're trained to acquire when you're studying to be an engineer. But then, of course, you have to solve all these specific problems. You have to build a bridge here and a highway there. He's got to stand up.
That's
and,
right.
We have increasing problems with this in the United States where we're reluctant to invest in infrastructure. So I think that's true. And I think for Madison, the first part of engineering in a Republican government had to be the process of representation and legislation.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be the process of how do you get the right people elected. And how do you get them to deliberate under the best conditions? And then, in fact, that's what chapter two of the book is about. And I think Madison drew a lot of really cynical lessons about that. Maybe a few from his experience in the Continental Congress, though I think that the real dominant experience was his kind of disillusionment with the legislators he met, back here in Virginia.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, he had his falling out with Hamilton later, but he also had a real falling out with Patrick Henry.
Right.
And that's, I think that that has to affect anybody, is when you look at someone as a mentor, you look up to him, you work with him, right. You're really good friends, and all of a sudden you realize you've got this major, major difference in that case on the issue of religion.
Right.
And then that's really, that's got to affect you, really, personally. But before we leave the topic, I just have to say I smiled when I saw that, and I saw your reference to constitutional engineering. You sent a boy to Princeton. I sent a boy to California. He went to Caltech, and he did all the theory and all that, you know, the high-level math and all that. But I have never seen him happier than when he was working at a local machine shop and was covered with oil and grease. That's his happiest time, is when he's actually working. Now, he needs the theory, and he applies the theory. Yeah. But it's the messy working with the hand stuff, and that's medicine. He liked to get his hands dirty. He liked to go out there and figure out what needed to be done.
Yeah, and I think it's true. I think one of medicine, I think one of the keys of medicine's success is he was, I think he understood on the basis of his legislative experience, or his, let's say his deliberative experience, both in the Continental Congress and back in the Virginia House of Delegates. I think he understood the importance of controlling the agenda.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Jack Rakove, who's a member of Montpelier's board and also a historian and political scientist from Stanford University, all about his new book, A Politician Thinking, The Creative Mind of James Madison. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Jack. Stick around. And now let's finish our discussion with Jack Rakove of Stanford University, who's written a new book about James Madison focused upon the practical and game theoretic aspects of Madison's thinking. Madison was not just a theoretician. Madison was not just a great thinker. He was a practical politician, and he had some practical lessons that he had gleaned from his own experience.
That's a point I always make to my students, because my law students, because that's a very practical lesson for Madison. The best way to control the outcome of a meeting is to control the inputs.
Right.
You're the guy who shows up first, as Madison did in Philadelphia. You're the guy who has the plan. You're the guy who gets buy-in from the key players as they arrive. And then, lo and behold, the Virginia plan really did hold up pretty well throughout the summer of 1787.
Yes and no.
There were wins and losses.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm actually always struck by how similar the inputs and the outcome and the outputs are.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, the New Jersey plan, which actually was discussed very briefly, but it did represent, a perfectly plausible, credible alternative. You know, the idea there would be you take the existing structure of the Confederation, a unicameral Congress where each state had an equal vote, and you just try to identify which additional powers does it need, and let's try that first before we do something more radical. But Madison, and his allies had effectively ruled that proposition out, and I think they succeeded from the get-go in getting a different agenda in front of the convention that became dominant. Now, Madison lost. The things he valued most were exactly the particular objectives he valued most were the things he lost, and so he was
somewhat...
Could
you explain what those are, please?
Yeah, sure. He wanted, for one thing, he believed you should have some form of proportional voting in both houses of Congress. He thought the idea of an equal state vote was preposterous. As a Californian, actually, I got to ask this to Senator Barroso. I did a dinner at the Library of Congress, hosted by David Rubenstein with a bunch of members of Congress.
Who's a very generous benefactor.
Very generous benefactor of Montpelier and many other things. And I wound up having dinner with John Barroso, who's a somewhat humorless Republican senator from Wyoming. So I finally got to ask him the question I often put to my students. Why does Wyoming have two senators?
Right.
You know, what sense does that make? So Madison lost that issue, So we had the Senate is, full of rotten boroughs, which actually some of them created by the Republican Party at the end of the 19th century. So that's one point he lost. Second point he lost was, perhaps the one power he wanted most was to give the national government a negative on state laws.
And that's really remarkable. You want to talk about a nationalist perspective. Madison actually wanted the Congress to be able to essentially veto. He called it a negative.
Yeah.
An act of a state.
Well, veto is first person in Latin. So,
Right.
Yeah. So negative in grammatical terms is a better term.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. But, I mean, that's just remarkable. The state of Wyoming passes a statute.
Right.
And then the Congress says, no, Wyoming, you're not going to do that. We're simply going to abolish it.
Right. It would destroy any pretense to state sovereignty.
Did Madison feel so strongly?
Well, it's a subject of a lot of the analysis, and the basis for it again appears in his memorandum on the vices of the political system. But Madison said there were two reasons, and there two very powerful reasons. One was he worried about situations in which state governments would continue to try to thwart national legislation. Even if you gave Congress the legislative power that Madison wanted it to have, states could do any of a number of things to try to prevent that power from being exercised effectively. So if you think about the famous case McCulloch versus Maryland, the great case about the Second Bank of the United States in 1819, that would be in some ways the most obvious example of how this would play out. So that's a kind of simple federalism problem. You want the system to work, you have to prevent the states from being able to interfere with it. The second part, though, is, I think, in many ways the more interesting part is Madison reformulated the problem of how do you protect rights so it would apply to a Republican government. The usual argument about rights, civil rights, like, freedom of conscience, for example, or other civil rights, was that the real problem was how do you prevent the people as a whole, how do you enable the people as a whole to be secure against the concentrated power of the state, particularly meaning the concentrated power of the executive branch. Madison says that model doesn't work in a republic. You have to figure out where does the real power lie? That's the phrase he uses. Where does the real power lie? In the United States, the real power actually lies, Madison concludes, in a majority of the people. And the real victims of the abuse of power will be minorities and individuals. So that's a very, to us, this is so much common sense that we, I think we fail to see what a radical, novel, innovative concept it was. Madison saying the problem is not to protect the people as a whole, the citizens as a whole, against the concentrated power of the state. The real problem is how do you protect minorities and individuals against the legislative power of the majority. And then Madison makes an argument and says, well, the real problem, so then we have to ask the question, where is it more or less likely that the wrong kinds of majorities will coalesce? And he does a simple numerical kind of quasi-statistical analysis, which says, well, the smaller the entity, the easier it is to get a skewed distribution. Meaning, if you have a large extended national republic, like the United States is already and is going to become even more so over the future, you're going to have so many diverse interests, factions, et cetera, it's going to be very hard for the wrong kinds of majorities to form or to persist. But at the state level, that may not be the case. The states are going to remain small enough or compact enough or whatever that those kinds of majorities can in fact cohere. And I think, if you want to take a kind of mega view of American history and ask, well, does Madison's analysis make sense? The best example is look at the example of Jim Crow legislation, in its heyday from the late 19th century down to the mid-20th century, down to the 1960s.
Down at a state level.
Yeah, I mean, and the national government's complicit. I mean, thanks to Woodrow Wilson,
sure,
who you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Wilson, who I think in many ways was a virtuous president, but represented kind of orthodox racist attitudes of the early 20th century.
It's very interesting too, because my own limited political experience was on the local level in county government, and it's been my experience that counties are some of the most corrupt entities in the United States, and perhaps for that Madisonian reason, because it doesn't take that many people to form a cabal, often called the good old boy network, and then they get a stranglehold on local government, and no one can oppose them. Maybe Madison had a point.
I think that's what I like to say in some ways. If you ask, it's kind of a trick answer on my part, but say, what's the most Madisonian part of the Constitution? Usually I like to say Section 1 of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, you make that point at the end of the book.
I made it in my other book, too. It's just in original meetings. Well, because, I assume Madison's analysis was correct, that the states, here the states are much more culpable than the national government, and the 14th Amendment becomes the juridical basis for enabling institutions of national government, now primarily the judiciary, though, of course, the 14th Amendment was meant to authorize Congress more than the court.
Indeed, it did. In fact, just for a point of reference, it begins, no state shall.
Right.
No
right.
state shall. And then it goes through
right.
deny due process,
right.
deny
right.
equal protection.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And then, as you point out, right. later on, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment gives Congress the specific authority to enforce that by
right.
appropriate legislation. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, often called the Reconstruction
right.
Amendments, were the first to have language of that sort. And it was very,
right.
very specific, very nationalist. The national government is going to basically make sure the states don't misbehave too badly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, no, I personally think it's a great point, but it, you know, it is, you know, I mean, I agree.
But very good. I'm glad you agree.
But it's, yeah, but in a certain sense, that, you know, that application is perfectly consistent.
Yeah.
Fully perfectly consistent with Madison's original theory.
Well, then I have to ask you, though, of course, because Madison went through his phases, and a lot of people will see him as a great champion of states' rights, and they'll especially point to the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. Could we briefly discuss that? Well, did Madison become a states' rights guy at some point?
Yeah, I think that's always a kind of great misrepresentation of Madison's position. So, although he lives long enough, since he lives in almost another 40 years after the resolutions came out, he understands the dangerous consequences that they had. So I think Madison's and actually it's not a subject of the book, though.
Yeah, you mentioned it at the end, the nullification crisis.
Yeah, just in passing.
Let me summarize what I read, and you can tell me if I got it right. Basically, Madison, during the Virginia-Kentucky resolutions with his buddy Thomas Jefferson, interposed or sought to interpose the states between the national government and the people who were being oppressed then by the Alien Sedition Acts, but not in the sense of actually trying to nullify or prevent enforcement of the statute, simply as a way to protest them.
Right.
That was his understanding.
No, that's the major point of scholarly contention. So Jefferson's position, so Jefferson is the presumed author of the Kentucky resolutions.
Right.
And Jefferson's presumed position does flirt with the doctrine of interposition and nullification.
So nullification, right.
Yeah. So the idea is that, the states can actively intervene to prevent the enforcement of constitutionally dubious acts done by the national government. Madison's position is much more political in nature. Madison's basic position is that the state legislatures, just because the states were the original compacting parties of the Union, have the authority, have the ability to act politically. So they can continue to agitate against the Alien Sedition Acts. They can try to, in effect, influence public opinion, maybe encourage their senators, who were elected by the state legislatures, to rethink their position. But Madison, I think, is talking primarily about political argument. He's not talking about legal intervention. And Madison writes, it's one of those curious occasions. There's a letter that Madison writes to Jefferson, it's right around Christmas, 1798, give or take a day or two, where almost in an offhand way, he points out to Jefferson, here's something maybe you need to think about a little bit more deeply. It's just, it's one of those, it's actually another aspect of Madison thinking, that sometimes you find him almost not stumbling, but kind of, he's writing a letter, then suddenly this really powerful thought just drops into the text. Like his first argument about what we call the problem of the factious majority, which is one of the key themes of Federalist 10, whether a majority in a republic can ever be factious, can ever be acting improperly, is theoretically a difficult question. He first introduces that, in an almost offhand way, in a letter he wrote to James Monroe in the fall of 1786. So the letter to Jefferson about the difference between the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions has the same kind of character. Madison's writing along, and then suddenly this very powerful thought just kind of pops out and appears on the page.
Well, I like the point you make. You have to look beyond Federalist 10 and 51. Really do.
Right.
Those are the ones
that
are the most often quoted,
authored
by Madison. But he, as you say, he popped out with these ideas kind of in an offhand way. And he lived, actually, long enough to see the nullification crisis, where states actually did try to actively nullify federal laws and John C. Calhoun and all the rest of that. So he was not a fan of John C. Calhoun's.
No, he was not a fan of John C. Calhoun.
Okay.
It's funny. I don't know enough about their dealings. Calhoun appears in National Politics right around the end of the War of 1812. I've never thought to act. It's a gap in my knowledge. Did they interact at all while Madison was still president?
That's your next book. Jimmy and Johnny.
I have another next book I have to write first.
Oh, okay. All right. Very, very interesting. Okay. Well, at the end of your book, you make several interesting points about the future and the future of Madison scholarship. So could you summarize those for us? What needs to be done next?
Well, I think the 2 points I make, hope I remember them correctly, is that we could still pay a lot more attention. Actually, I thought this would be part of the book politician thinking, but in the end it isn't. What could be, you know, to think more systematically about how Madison thought about the Constitution during the 20 years of retirement he spent here at Montpelier.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of individual letters we look at that confirm particular points. There is an excellent book by Drew McCoy called The Last of the Fathers, which is primarily about the retirement years and focuses on Madison's, you know, attitudes about slavery and race relations and the like. And that's a great book and a, you know, very powerful book and forces you to do a lot of thinking. But it doesn't cover the whole array of issues. So I think that needs some consideration, or that could be done more systematically. And then the other thing is, I think Madison's presidency remains understudied,
especially the War of 1812.
Which dominates his presidency. Although there's a very good book by John Stagg, you know, who's here in Charlottesville, who's part of the Madison Papers Project, called Mr. Madison's War. And Noah Feldman, in his new biography, which I haven't gotten to yet, you know, does talk about Madison as president, but. There is a theory. Gordon Wood has developed this argument pretty well, and I think I endorse it, that Madison's idea about executive power at the time of the convention were not, I think those ideas were not well-formed, and he himself confesses as much. They became much more focused during the 1790s, particularly because of the foreign policy crises that begin with George Washington's second administration, begin in 1793 and go on through the rest of the decade, and then, of course, on into Madison's term as Secretary of State and President. So he becomes much more aware of the dimensions of how much autonomy and influence a president can have. I think that went far beyond anything Madison ever anticipated back in the 1780s. So I think when he became president, he tried to exercise the presidency in a way that was consistent with his constitutional principles. That may or may not have been the best way to conduct the presidency in wartime. You know, Madison has a lot of critics who argue that he was a terrible wartime president. But he has some admirers who say, well, if you're concerned with this other set of principles, that you don't want to use a national emergency to enlarge executive power beyond its proper constitutional and Republican bounds, then maybe Madison was more successful than we've realized. And to me, it's a very interesting fact. Think about George W. Bush leaving office in 2009 with, I think his administration largely discredited because of his disastrous foreign policy mistakes in Iraq, a very unpopular war. And I think George W. Bush carried the legacy of that, back to Texas. Madison, when he left, was a very popular president. The War of 1812 was not a great military adventure, though Andrew Jackson brings it.
I think Andrew Jackson may have saved his bacon.
But that worked to Jackson's advantage. Why should it work to Madison's? I think that Madison's conduct or Madison's refusal, Madison could have tried to conduct a much more vigorous presidency. Could have tried to act more vigorously against the kind of dissident states in New England. He kind of lets them go their own way. He doesn't try to crack down up there the way he might have in wartime. So I think trying to think through the implications of Madison's presidency, at a moment in our history when the nature of executive power in emergency times is, still before us.
Fascinating subject.
Not a bad subject.
Very good subject. Well, Jack Rakoff of Stanford University and a member of the board here at Montpelier, thanks very much for your time.
Great to be here.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Jack Rakoff of Stanford University, who's just written a fascinating book, A Politician Thinking, The Creative Mind of James Madison. Go out and buy 10 or 15 copies. It'll make you smarter. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.